Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS. I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and William, AC2ZV, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics that are covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like to find it, simply use the URL, type in puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments on this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and William AC2ZV will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, William AC2ZV. Good evening, William. Oh, well, there was a possibility that William might be a little bit late to the technical net. So with that in mind, I hope he comes soon. But it's now open for business. If you have any questions or topics that you'd like to discuss or comments you'd like to make, then please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Well, once again, it's a slow start to the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Once again, I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and we've been doing this for a couple of years now. Every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m., we get together, and we do this Technical Net. And I think one time, absolutely nothing happened. And so we just kind of folded our tents and went back into the desert. Let me, if there's anyone else out there listening even, if you're unaware, if you're a member of the American Radio Relay League, the ARRL, they recently sent emails out that they were considering increasing their membership dues, and gosh, did they. They not only went from a baseline of, I believe it's $49 a year, which included the QST magazine, they kicked that up to $59 a year and removed the printed version of QST magazine. As a member, you still have the right and privilege to go to the website and to read QST electronically, as you can. I think there's a contest a quarterly called NSJC, maybe, and there is a higher tech quarterly publication called QEX, All of those are available on their website to be read. But if you want a hard copy, that's an additional $25 to have it sent to you. So it comes to approximately, if you're interested in getting the hard copy magazine, which I assume many people are, it's a 30% increase, which is a heck of an increase. You know, they say that they haven't increased their dues in a long time, but still, 30%, you know, you think you start slowly, work your way up. Nevertheless, so if you are an ARRL member, effective January 1st, 2024, the new dues will come into effect. So be aware of that. Once again, I remain AC2GS, Roy. This remains the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, and I'm basically talking to myself here. So if there's anyone else out there who would like to check in, who has any questions or comments for the Technical Net tonight, then please hit that push to talk and say your piece.
Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform.
Hello there. How are you this fine night?
Doing well. Just saying hello, letting you know somebody's out here. Just finished work, so, you know, living the dream out here in Astoria. AD2DU,
open. Alex, anything going on hobby-wise with you tonight?
Yeah, my question is, can you explain why an antenna tuner wouldn't help on
Let me just double check what you asked me. Did you ask me why an antenna tuner wouldn't work on receive? I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, whether tuning your antenna doesn't help you to receive signals, or if your question is, why can't you just not use a transmitter, but just leave it on receive and be able to tune your antenna tuner? So I need you to be a little bit more specific there.
Does a receive-only antenna ever tune the antenna? Or another way, would I be able to tune an antenna outside of the band, like to hear shortwave bands better?
Okay, let me just, theoretically, you can tune to off-band frequencies. It's a little bit more difficult to know when you've reached the right place. Most antenna tuners use an SWR meter, which calculates your SWR or how well you've transformed the impedance by checking on the return reflection. What happens is you send X number of watts down your transmission line. It reaches your antenna that's designed with a 50-ohm impedance. If you're, if that's what's happening, it's going from a 50-ohm impedance in your shack to a 50-ohm impedance to your antenna, you have a perfect one-to-one. You should have no reflections, so the amount of reflected energy is very close to zero. As your antenna is less and less matched, you have a higher and higher percentage of reflected power, and your SWR meter is designed to take that ratio of forward to reverse power and calculate the approximate SWR. Obviously, if you're not transmitting, you're not reflecting any power, so you can't get a reading. That doesn't necessarily mean that you can't use your antenna tuner if only for receiving. Just that you have two basic methods to get an idea of whether you're tuned. The best, if you have a vector network analyzer, which you can now buy for about $50-$60, you can plug it into the output of your antenna tuner, and you can adjust the antenna tuner for 50-ohm impedance. That would give you a very nice, accurate way of knowing it. If you do not have a vector network analyzer, you have to do a somewhat crude measure, which is to simply listen to the background noise on the given frequency that you're interested in. Theoretically, as your antenna tuner approaches a one-to-one SWR, you'll have maximum transfer of received signal and the noise generated into the audio stream of your receiver will be the loudest. So at the loudest noise point will be where you have the closest match.
So, like, is the chip on my Texan TL-990 shortwave radio doing any sort of, like, manipulation of the antenna if it's not extended to the exact correct length, or you use a different wire or a different external antenna with it?
I'm not exactly clear what you mean. I assume you have a Yaesu 990. I don't know. It sort of depends upon the radio, what it's capable of. There are radios that simply have an output. There are radios that have a built-in antenna tuner. But if you want to use the built-in antenna tuner, it's usually an automatic one, and it requires a transmitted signal, again, to detect how much of energy is being reflected back. So what happens with transceivers with built-in antenna tuners is that they go through an algorithm to minimize the amount of reflected power that they get back. So they have a directional coupler built into them and a meter and such. I think that's what the question was, but if not, please rephrase it.
So in practice, if I want to use my IC7300 ICOM radio with the waterfall display on the front to listen to the shortwave broadcast band, I would right now go to the nearest ham band and tune the antenna, and then scroll over to the broadcast band?
Well, yeah, I mean, theoretically, yeah. If you have indicators, I mean, on my antenna tuners, there's no band indicators. It's just a matter of rotating inductors and rotating capacitors. But if you have some kind of an indicator for the ham bands, probably the best starting point would be to set it for the closest frequency of a ham band and then just keep adjusting. Again, it sort of depends on the antenna tuner. Some are just kind of, they go from one end of the spectrum to the other, and then there are others that have switched in components, so they're optimized for the ham bands. If that's the case, then it kind of limits your abilities, as opposed to, like I said, something with, usually you can kind of tell, it either has three controls or two controls. One is to adjust the inductance, and the other two is the first or the second capacitor. And in some antenna tuners, they're coupled together so that if you increase the first capacitor with the same action, it decreases the capacitance of the second capacitor. So it depends on what kind of antenna tuner. If it's not stepped, then just put it to some place that's reasonably close in ham bands, and then just turn the knobs and see what happens to your pan adapter, and try to get the noisiest noise floor that you can find. That's a pretty good indicator that you're coming close to a 1-to-1 SWR.
In practice, like in the field, if you're using a manual antenna tuner, do you have to measure the SWR every single time you change frequency? 82 to you, over.
This is KD2EEA. Looks like we might have lost Roy.
Let me just check. Okay, I'm back again. The push-to-talk is a little bit futzy, what can I tell you? So I have to actually double-check to make sure that I'm transmitting. What I attempted to tell you, Alex, was that it depends upon the bandwidth/Q of the antenna and the difference between your first frequency transmission and your second. So if you have a center-fed dipole and you're going 3 kilohertz on 10 meters, you probably don't have to retune anything. If you're using something with a much higher Q, like a magnetic loop, if you sneeze on it, you're going to have to retune it. And if you're going to go more than 3, 4, 5 kilohertz on that 10-meter center fed, you probably need to tweak it a little bit. So it has to do with the bandwidth of the antenna design and the difference in frequency that you're moving to.
Got it. Thank you. That's helpful. I think I heard El Presidente checking in there. Was that Max? Over.
Max, Alex asked if you're out there. I heard you out there.
Hey, yeah, I'm here. That's KD2VA, Max. I just was butting in because, Roy, we lost you there for a second. But I have a different question from last night's net when we're ready.
Sure. It's just a matter of, I just want to make sure that Alex got his answer. Any other questions, Alex?
Not at the moment. Well, let somebody else have a shot. I can think up ham radio questions all night because I have a lot of equipment I don't know how to use. Over.
Okay, very good. Well, we'll be here until no one needs us to be here. So, Maxim, what's your question from last night?
I don't quite recall who was asking this last night. But they were asking about, like, so we were on Echolink, and they were talking about Texas has a bunch of, I think, all-star repeaters or all-star configurations, and that is more instantaneous in terms of the delay that we have with Echolink, and I don't know anything about it, and I was wondering if you did.
Yeah, I know about All-Star. All-Star is very unusual. It's sort of a lot like Echolink, but I don't know. Every so often when I talk to people who are into All-Star, I get the vibe that it's a cultish type of a thing. The point is that there are three methods of interfacing our radios and repeaters and such with the internet that use some version of internet over voice protocol. One, of course, is lovely little Echolink. It's free. It doesn't require any hardware, and it does have a delay. The other is called IRLP, which is primarily not designed in the same way that the other two are. It's designed primarily to relay and connect repeaters directly themselves. So what you would do is you wouldn't have an IRLP node in your house, although a few people have experimental nodes if they plead with the people in charge of it a great deal. What happens is you'll link a repeater that has IRL capability to another repeater that has IRL capability for the LIMARC. Every Sunday night on the technical net, there's two Ontario-based repeaters that switch in IRLP to the W2VL repeater. So the people in Ontario can hear the people at LIMARC, and LIMARC can theoretically hear the people from Ontario. The third type is what you were talking about. It requires its own hardware node, so you have to purchase something. I think they go for a couple of $100s, and they hook up into your internet connection and the radio, and it sort of works in the same way that Echolink does. So does it have better latency? Maybe. Is it inexpensive? No. Every so often we will have people with that connection link as a conference on our Echolink node. So there's a lot of going back and forth between the two methods. Up until recently, it wasn't a part of a LIMARC service. They decided to use it as their interlink method, so it's included now, which causes their Echolink capability to not be good. In the old days when they had regular Echolink, you could look on the table and see who was on. They would give you the call sign and the first name. If you have your EchoLink running, which I think you do, you know what I mean. It's, you know, it tells you who's on. If you go through the other mode, you end up with an EchoLink that just gives people their node number, not their names, which I find not much fun, personally.
That's interesting. So it would have to have more hardware, which means more cost.
Yep, that's the gist of it. It's another box, another thing to be configured, another thing to be plugged into. And although I guess theoretically you could have that in EchoLink, it just kind of probably increases the complications that are already somewhat complicated exponentially.
So that box would have to be connected to the internet in order to achieve this, right? Or is it connecting repeaters to repeaters?
It would have to be both connected to the internet and to the radio.
So how is that any different from the setup we have for WireZX? Just the same idea, just different protocol?
To a degree, yes. It's a little bit different in that you're probably using proprietary digital streams for the WireZX, whereas it might not be quite as proprietary for the other method. It just might be some generic flavor of voice over internet protocol. And it just feeds to a different server, whereas WireZX feeds to the Japanese Yaesu server farm. This goes to some other place where the powers that be that maintain that link do their magic. So it's the same ultimate principle, but it's designed far more for analog than the digital domain that WireZX is built up for.
That makes sense. Thank you for that explanation. By the way, I've been listening both on EchoLink and on the radio, and I would say the delay is probably about half a second, maybe as much as a second, maybe, so it's not too bad.
Yeah, I personally don't have that much of a problem. The only major problem with EchoLink is the tendency for people to quick key. When you only have one or two people listening to a net, it's much less likely. If you ever listen to what goes on the Limark technical net, there was a time that I had to fall back to EchoLink and I couldn't get on my own net because everyone was quick keying each other. So as long as you give a little bit of time, that's not really a problem. Where you get the real problematic latency delays is Icecast, which is the method I'm using to stream the audio completely over the internet, where, you know, you don't need to have a call sign to access it. With Icecast, it could be easily 20 seconds of latency delay. But I mean, you know, if you're not really talking back and forth, which Icecast is not designed for back and forth, you know, if you're just listening to everything delayed, shouldn't be that much of a problem.
Indeed, and I gotta say, in a pinch or when I am not that close to my radio, it's kind of nice to have EchoLink, even though I might be mere feet away. But if I'm in the kitchen doing some dishes, my radio is kind of plugged into the antenna over here. My Bluetooth that's connected to my radio does not quite reach, so it's actually, I get a better connection by listening to EchoLink than I get to my radio. So, you know, it comes in handy even when not traveling.
AC2GS. Well, it's good to hear, Max. I thought it would be useful for the club. The price of the software was perfect, zero. And I just had to rig up a lot of stuff and figure out how to get things in, out, and around and be able to plug myself into it at the same time, which was took a little bit of time and a little bit of thought, but it worked out in the long run. So, you know, I'm glad to provide the service for the club.
And we appreciate it. This is KG2VEA. Let's see if anybody else has any questions.
Yes, indeed. This is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m. If anyone out there has any questions for the TechNet, please hit that push to talk and ID yourself, give me your first name and your call sign. Well, it looks like it's the three of us. So, Alex, if you've thought up a new question, feel free.
Sure. On a software-defined radio dongle, like an AirSpy or a RTL SDR, what are they sell an up converter item that I think convert to the ham band. What is that thing? And why do you need it? Why can't the RTL SDR just do it with the right antenna without another piece of hardware to do it? 82 to you, over.
Okay, that's a good question. Things like the, I don't know if the first dongle you mentioned, but I know the second dongle you mentioned, the RTL SDR, is designed off of a repurposed chip that was originally designed and fabricated in the millions to be the heart of European over-the-air digital video technology. That's what the massive amount of chips manufactured brought the individual price so far low that we hams, who tend to be cheap, thought that we could tinker around with it. And indeed, you can tinker around with it. You can repurpose it from a much higher frequency video broadcast receive device to a lower frequency device at the cost of dynamic range, signal to noise ratio, and all kinds of specifications. It's primarily designed to operate on the VHF UHF range. It's not designed to operate on HF. You can operate it on HF, but the signal will be not very good. This is why people will often buy up converters. These will convert HF frequencies coming in your antenna to a higher frequency, which you can then far better decode with an RTL SDR. So the converters are meant to augment the inexpensive chipset of the RTL SDR so that you'll have a better dynamic range and signal-to-noise ratio and a better experience. You will get something if you just plug in the RTL SDR to a proper antenna and the proper software, but you will find reception much better if you use a converter before you do that.
Yeah, that makes sense. The first company was AirSpy, AirSpy. They have a model, the nicer model of the AirSpy HF Discovery, and the older one is, I think, in R2. But what free software do you use on the computer with the RTL SDR, for example? I think I have two of those things. Over.
Yeah, there is a bunch of free software available. The best thing to do is Google, if you're going to use the chipset in the RTL SDR, there's a guy in New Zealand, Carl Laufer, who's no relation to me, who has books and websites. If you just Google RTL SDR, you'll find, I think it's rtlsdr.com, where it's like an encyclopedia on the subject, and he includes links and descriptors for all kinds of open source software. The last one I heard was SDR Sharp, which let you kind of plug in software modules with each other to kind of change the nature of the software. But there's got to be at least a dozen different open source pieces of software out there that will utilize the RTL SDR USB connection into your computer. You can even get a bunch of programs that run on a Raspberry Pi using an RTL SDR that will give you a receiver and all kinds of cute little things that you can play around with.
Your HF radio is a Flex, if I remember correctly, right?
Yes, indeed. It is a Flex 6700. Unfortunately, I think they were having problems finding replacement parts, so they've retired that model about a month or two ago.
Those are what I look at, you know, as they, like, people look at Ferraris on the internet. They look pretty fun. But it's the same, I mean, they're all the newer radios that have the SDR technology rather than the analog. I think the only analog radio I have is the Texan PL680. I still have a weakness for buying shortwave radios. But the software is demonstrated to be better for noise reduction and everything. Is it not? Is analog still used at all in these things?
Well, number one, I wouldn't quite call mine a Ferrari, maybe a Cadillac. Ferrari, I guess I would think more of, there's a German transceiver out there that I think goes for a list price of $25,000, whereas at the height of my flick of 6700, I think it cost me about $7,500. So not quite a Ferrari, but yeah, there's still legacy analog antennas, radios, being manufactured and sold. And in some cases, especially when it's a dual band antenna radio, one of the bands is straight SDR, and the other one is a kind of half-assed modified SDR. Software-defined radios means that the signal is computationally, digitally detected. But theoretically, the SDR components can start anywhere from the front end of the radio, such as mine, and the full SDR type of radios. They go into an analog RF amplifier, some filtering, and then straight into a digitizer. But it is possible, and I think Yaesu sells a few, where it's analog all the way to the IF stage. And at the IF stage, that's when they plug it into a lower-costing digitizer and do the SDR magic from that point on. So you'll have a much narrower bandwidth range. You know, my Flex 6700, I can put it up on my screen and look at most of the HF bands. Whereas if you're taking the SDR signal through an IF stage, it's limited by the bandwidth of the IF stage, how much you can generate on a PAN adapter.
Digital radios have to overcome soft muting, where it like mutes out and annoys your ear when you change to a different channel. Is that just them overcoming it through computing power?
Okay, once again, I'm not quite sure what the question exactly means. Using software, you can manipulate filters and audio much more sophisticated. In the analog world, it's very difficult to have cutoffs that are near instantaneous. The closer and closer you get to a kind of square wave on-off operation, the more you tend to produce a lot of background noise. In digital technology, though, you can trick things and have very, very sharp cutoffs. Filters can be very sharp without. In analog, it's called ringing. You can build software algorithms that act as filters that don't have ringing. So I think that's what you were asking.
A cheap handheld AM some FM radio that's digital will mute out as you're tuning it, and it hurts your ear. What's the IF stage, by the way? You mentioned that. I should know this from radio class.
Let me try the first comment first, and then we'll get to the second comment. The first comment is there's a big difference. Digital, the problem is a lot of people get a lot of things confused about software-defined radio. A lot of times they think that a software-controlled radio is a software-defined radio. Since about 15, 20 years ago, most radios have CPUs in them, so the controller can be remotely controlled. There was a CIV protocol, there was an RS-232 port, and a lot of relatively older radios can be either remotely or in-person computer-controlled. Those are not software-defined radios. There are digital modes. FT8 is a famous one. Morse code is really a digital mode. D-Star, Fusion, DMR. That simply means that the signal is digitally encoded, encrypted, and the ones and zeros are transmitted using a modulation method that sends it out. But you can have an analog radio that does digital radio because the two are not identical. So that's that aspect. The second one, unfortunately, I completely forgot, so please ask me again.
You mentioned in the internal workings of the radio, the IF stage. I forget what the IF stage is.
Okay, now that's good. So you got different stages in your radio. You have the front end, we call it, which is basically a broadband RF amplifier. So whatever signal the microvolts that your antenna picks up and drains out of the transmission line goes to a high gain, low noise broadband RF amplifier. That's the front end. Then it goes to a bunch of RF filters so that off-frequency signals don't compete for the frequency that you're interested in and desense it. That then goes to another stage of amplification. And then because most modern-day analog antennas are what's called super heterodyne, they do not filter the original frequency you're receiving does not go through too much amplification and filtration. Instead, you put it to a mixer, you mix it down to a different frequency so that if you're listening to, say, 10 meters or 20 meters, at that point at the intermediate frequency, it's the same frequency. So you don't have to design amplifiers and filters for different frequencies. You can build a very extensive one for one intermediate frequency, which is what IF stands for. And you use that to do the proper amplification, filtration before you squirt it into a detector where it then detects the RF down to an audio stream.
How does your Flex radio do multiple instances of WSJ-TX? Or like, how does it do FT8 two windows at once? Are there two transmitters in it?
Yes, it has two real radios in it, and each of those real radios can branch out and act as four virtual radios. So I could theoretically put on eight different frequency ranges on my window at the same time, but I could only use, you know, transmitter A or transmitter B. There is no transmitter C. So I could receive eight different FT8s, but if I wanted to operate them, and probably it wouldn't be a great idea to operate two at the same time. You can kind of alternate between them, but if you tried to transmit both at the same time, I don't think that would be a very, very good thing to practice. But generally speaking, it has two transmitters, two receivers, and each of the receivers are capable of operating as four virtual receivers.
Wallpaper must be incredible. I should let somebody else ask a question. AD2DU, over.
Yeah, well, when I had my fan dipole, the trick with something like an FT with a Flex 6700 is unless you have an antenna farm and you have some very, very interesting ways of blending the signals together without destroying everything, you get a very broadband antenna design. I had a fan dipole that went from sort of 80 meters to 10 meters. With something like that, then it's beautiful to look at. The whole window is filled up from 80 meters to 10 meters, and you can tell what's going on where. Anyway, I'll give it a try, Alex. Things have been kind of quiet, but who knows? Maybe someone has dropped by. I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m. If you're out there or you have any questions of technical nature, then please hit that push-to-talk button and check in. Give us your first name and your call sign. Ah, good to have you aboard. What's your first name again?
My name is Zach with a Zulu.
Okay, very good, Zach. Glad to have you aboard. Do you have any questions or topics for tonight?
I don't. I was a little bit late to the party here. Only hopped on about 15 minutes ago, but I just wanted to say you guys are doing a great job, and I'm enjoying listening for sure. I'm relatively new to New York, and kind of trying to get back into the swing of an active ham community, and enjoyed this and the club meeting the other night. So I appreciate you guys putting on events like this and spreading the wealth of knowledge, and I just want to say I've enjoyed listening tonight.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that, Zach. We're here, like I said, every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. Of course, you heard our InfoNet every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Columbia University has their own net on our repeater every Monday night at 9 p.m. And we also have a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock on 28.380 upper sideband. We get together and we chew the rag.
I really enjoy HF, so I may see if I can hop on one of the 10-meter nets for sure. So, yeah, I just want to say thanks, guys. I appreciate it. It was a really nice informational session tonight, and I'll try to join more often. This is NC1W back to net.
Okay, very good, Zach. 73, and hope to talk to you down the line. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. And if anyone has any questions or comments for tonight, then please hit that push to talk.
AD2VEA, another comment?
Yes, Max.
Done a little bit of RTL SDR, and I've used two software packages. One is SDR Sharp on Windows, and it works decently well. And on Mac, I used let me look up the name.
Yeah, I mean, there's a load of open source. Flex original series had a control program that was open source, and that was kind of used as the basis for a lot of other radios, and the manufacturers felt that they were stiffed out of the developmental costs. And so when they came up with the Flex 6000 series, they made it incredibly proprietary, unfortunately. But I mean, outside of Flex, a lot of hardware SDRs are capable of being controlled with a never-ending supply of open-source software. Of course, you know, the major commercial companies now that are moving to SDR don't give you access to their SDR functions with non-proprietary software. So I doubt that we'll ever see a Yaesu or an ICOM, a shareware type of software to control those things, except the generic CIV-based ones.
That's true. So the other app I use is Cubic SDR, and that one is open source, and I actually had to recompile the newest version of it, and it works pretty well. But it's surprising how out of date some of the SDR software is. It looks like it was pretty popular in 2013, 2014, and then it kind of popularity died down. But I know that AirSpy is kind of one of those things that people really are pretty excited about. Like, I think that has a lot more support. It had actually a lot of fun because you can visually scroll and navigate
Yeah, I mean, the problem with open source, the price is right, and sometimes if the developers are clever and hardworking and driven, they bring out features that commercial software doesn't even have. The downside is you never quite know when the guy who wrote most of it is going to get tired or distracted or move on to something completely different. And either they could just, the software just kind of ages badly and fades away, or just disappears one day. We see it all the time with open source. Like, I loved TrueCrypt, and then one day it just ceased to exist. So that's the problem with all this. You got to kind of stay on your toes. What necessarily is some of the best software today is not going to be the same best software in a year or two. So, just have to be flexible.
And there was a lot of fun to be able to visually navigate. I know some of the newer radios have that built in, and that's, I think, the SDR components you were talking about, where you can visually see the waterfall across different frequencies. But I don't have that, and it was a lot of fun just to be able to identify transmissions. That's actually how I've hit a couple of repeaters when I was traveling. I had my laptop with me. I had that little dongle. I put it up. I kind of scroll through, see where people are transmitting, and then if I hear communications, then I go and look up what that frequency is, which often tends to be a repeater. So I've done that in D.C. and San Diego and in Boise, Idaho, and kind of like what ends up being pretty good way of hunting for repeaters.
Yeah, I AC2GS, by the way, I love pan adapters. I find it incredibly easy to notice activity. Every so often, I'll talk to an old-timer who just kind of squints at me and tells me that the only proper way of finding a signal is with your hand on a knob and your headphones on your ears. Okay, if that's what they like, then so be it with them. I like pan adapters. Even my ICOM 7100. Which is not the prettiest display in the world. It's a touch monochrome resistive touchpad. It has a very, very crude pan adapter where you can see signals to the right or the left of the frequency that you're on. So, I mean, it's certainly not an SDR, but it was something that they decided to build into it probably at the IF stage because, pan adapters were going to be a really big thing.
W comment?
Yeah, sure. Please, comment.
A disc cone. There's like a diamond disc cone on top of my house, and I used it for a lot of things, but they're really wide band receive, and so a lot of times I would have that into an SDR, and I get on my computer screen, I could see everything from, gigahertz down to, 160 meters. So I could scan really, really wide range visually, and then use my radio with my transmit antennas for HF to then go dial in and try to find something, so or to respond to something. It was a really good and inexpensive way to use the SDR to find signals.
Yeah, a DISCone is an excellent wideband receiver. You don't want to transmit on too many bands, but yeah, as receivers go, it's a perfect kind of accessory for a multi virtual receiver SDR.
That was exactly what I found. The one that I had, I think, was a diamond disc cone, and it would transmit pretty well, not high gain, but it would transmit 2 meters, 70 centimeters, and 6 meters. But receive-wise, I could receive even lower than it claimed. I think it said it would go to 40 meters, but I could do 80 easy and not too bad even on 160. So that with a relatively inexpensive SDR, it let me visualize and find signals almost across everything, right? And it was a really neat way to kind of check and see where the signals were, and then at that time I had a Yaesu 991 to then go actually try to find it on the radio to transmit to. But it was a really nice combination of having the disc cone and the SDR and then an HF rig or a UHF rig to respond in C1W.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's a good setup. I mean, I tended to like my fan dipole in that I could use it both for receiving and transmitting. So I didn't have to kind of switch over or have a receiving antenna versus a transmitting antenna. Although, you know, a lot of radios are reasonably well designed to operate in that mode.
Yeah, I agree completely. And it the place I had was relatively small, and I only had a dipole up on the roof. I didn't have a whole bunch of space, but that setup worked really, really well for me. And if anybody listening out there isn't familiar with disc cones, they're nice. They don't take up much space. They're not very expensive, and they're really wide band for receive. C1W, back to you guys.
Yeah, that's a good piece of advice. It's, you know, a lot of times people will have receiving antennas that just are designed to be better at receiving, and separate transmitter antennas. The classic receive only, especially for very low frequencies, or beverage antennas. They're rather than being standing wave antennas, they're traveling wave antennas. They have a small load resistor at the end, and they're very low noise and capable of working at very low frequencies if you have enough area. But they're very inefficient for transmitting. So yeah, there's a lot of setups where there are optimal receiving antennas and then optimal transmitting antennas, and they switch between the two. Well, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, and at 9 p.m., and that's what we're doing tonight. If anyone has any other questions or comments for tonight, please feel free to hit that push to talk. Okay, well, at least we surprisingly made it for an hour, which is pretty good. I hope everything's well with William. I assume that the few people remaining aren't particularly that interested one way or the other in the TechNet puzzle. I'll just throw it out and ask if anyone's interested. If not, we can always table it for August.
Know about everybody else. I'm interested. I wonder if anybody else is. Let's see if I can get one more vote for it.
I'm not familiar with what it is, but I'm up for a challenge.
Okay, very good. The TechNet puzzle is available on the club's website. You can either just type in puzzle.kc2rc.com, or you could go to the front page, and a little bit below the top, in orange-colored text, there's something that says TechNet Puzzle. You can click that. Fortunately, this particular one is purely text, so I can just read it to everyone. You don't even have to go there. The question is, what is the cause of receiver desensing? And you get four different choices. Choice A is multiple reflections from the ionosphere. Choice B is the Schwelch control is wrongly set. And answer C is the presence of a very strong signal on another frequency. And choice D is the core of a transformer is becoming saturated. So would anyone like to hazard a guess of what is of the four of these produces receiver desensing?
AD2VEA, I'm going to vote C.
And you are quite right. It is the presence of a very strong signal on another frequency. If you remember earlier when I was mentioning how the different stages of analog radios are work, it has a front end with a broad frequency, low noise, high gain amplifier, and then some filters to kind of block the bands that you aren't interested in, because otherwise a strong signal off frequency can kind of saturate the whole amplifier, and that's what's called desensing your radio. Effectively, what happens is your noise floor kind of jumps up. You see that on AM and single sideband, and even FM. When I am trying to transmit on FM, like right now, and also I'm trying to receive with an antenna that's maybe about 20 feet away, instead of a nice noise-free reception of the other frequency on VHF, it's very noisy. So the front end is desensed from the energy that I'm transmitting to our Kings County Radio Club repeater. So Max is right. It's the presence of a very strong signal on another frequency. Okay, I guess we've kind of done what we set out to do. I'll ask one last time if anyone has any questions or comments for the TechNet before we call it a night.
It was a great net, 82 to you.
Thank you very much, Alex. I appreciate it. We try our best here.
Appreciate it. After we're done, and I'd like to talk to you about for a second about the distribution, but that's pretty much it.
Okay. I will keep that in mind. Just one last time, if anyone has any closing comments, now's the time.
Thanks again for the net. This is NC1W clear.
Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be August 2nd, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin at 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly two-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. So we're going to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back August 9th when we'll do it all over again. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Take it easy. Be well, and we'll talk down the line. This is AC2GS formally closing this lovely episode of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net.